Hello, listeners. It is Thursday, May 18th, 2017. I'm Scott Bland, your host, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. We are going to talk this week all about the biggest news out of the White House, an explosive leak about President Trump's meeting with top Russian diplomats, another big leak that former FBI Director James Comey wrote memos claiming Trump asked him to not investigate a former top aide, and then the Wednesday appointment of a special counsel to run the investigation into ties between Russia and members of the Trump campaign. And to top it all off, we have another special election happening next week in Montana. That campaign is coming to a close during one of the craziest weeks yet of the Trump administration. We're going to break down a little bit of what's at stake, who the candidates are, and what the state of play is before that election in Montana's at-large district. Some quick housekeeping before we dive in. Remember, you can email us with questions at nerdcast@politico.com. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a written review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Remember, the more reviews and feedback we get, the higher we rise on the charts, and the easier it is for more people like you to discover us and create Nerdcast Nation. One more thing along those lines, we've created a survey to better get to know our listeners and create an even better show. So listeners, if you have 2 minutes, please take that time to fill out that quick survey at politico.com/podcast survey. That's politico.com/podcast survey. All right, let's jump in. Here's our panel this week. Senior politics editor Charlie Mattesian.
Hey,
back.
There.
Thank God.
Did you miss me?
We're lost without you, Charlie.
National politics reporter Eliana Johnson.
Hello.
And chief investigative reporter Ken Vogel.
Yep, that's me. Hi.
All right. Our first data point this week is the three huge separate yet linked stories of the sort that would typically dominate a month of a less eventful presidency. First, Trump's meeting with top Russian officials last week apparently included the disclosure of some very sensitive information, which caused an uproar within the intelligence community and ultimately was leaked to the Washington Post.
And in Israel.
That's right.
Intelligence came from. Oops.
Former FBI Director James Comey apparently wrote a memo while he was FBI Director saying that President Trump asked him to drop the investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. That leaked to the New York Times on Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, a special counsel was appointed to head up the investigation into ties between Trump's campaign and Russia. And to quote from the order appointing former FBI Director Robert Mueller as the special counsel, quote, any matters that arose or may arise indirectly from the investigation. So pretty wide berth there. Ken, let's start with James Comey and this memo that came out and the other memos that apparently exist, because I think from there we can get a little bit more into the why of the special counsel being appointed and everything else floating around the Trump administration right now.
Yeah, so the New York Times reviewed but did not obtain, or at least was not able to publish, this memo that Comey wrote after one of his meetings with Donald Trump early on, where he says in this memo that Trump essentially asked him to drop the FBI's investigation into Trump's then National Security Advisor, now former National Security Advisor, Mike Flynn. He wrote in the memo, quote, this is now this is Comey quoting Trump in Comey's memo. I hope you can see your way clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. He is a good guy. I hope you can let this go. That story was among the most traffic in the New York Times history on the New York Times website. Immediately generated this wave of condemnation from across the political spectrum. It was perceived, I think rightly so, as an effort to, ironically, to meddle in the FBI's investigation into Russia's meddling in the U.S. election and into ties between Trump's team and Russia. The Flynn investigation, obviously, or what we know of it at least, falling into the latter category of ties between Trump's team and Russia. Flynn is really at the center of this investigation. We understand he and Paul Manafort will be at the center of the continued investigation being conducted by the special prosecutor, Bob Mueller. And so these memos, which have now been requested and could possibly be subpoenaed by congressional investigators, could end up being a key piece of evidence here.
And Eliana, we talked last week after Comey was fired from his position as FBI director that this was probably not the last we'd be hearing from him. And this, it looks like he's going to get he's going to be testifying before Congress. It looks like these memos and other ones he may have written about interactions with the president are going to either get subpoenaed or otherwise brought forward. This seems like the firing was the end of a chapter of kind of like James Comey in public life, but not the end of the story.
Yeah, you know, I think ironically, Trump intended the firing to put an end to the Russia investigation, but it sparked a new chapter. First of all, it set off a chain of events that were, you know, it was a series of self-inflicted wounds where it actually led the Justice Department to appoint a special prosecutor. Now, you know, that being, I think, played in the media as something that's highly damaging to the Trump White House. I actually think that for a while we will see the drumbeat of Russian news die down because both Republicans and Democrats alike have an extraordinary amount of faith in former FBI Director Robert Mueller. And if, in fact, Trump is innocent, this is the best possible thing that could happen to them. He seemed a lot of the Russia stuff seemed to be self-inflicted. I don't think most people actually think, for example, that Attorney General Jeff Sessions did anything inappropriate or was colluding with the Russians. Nonetheless, he did something that from an optical perspective looked very damaging. Anyhow, I think having the investigation in capable hands may lead this to die down. If there's no there, that will come out. And so in a backhanded way, this may be good for the Trump White House. On the other hand, if there are guilty parties, it could be a very bad thing.
And it almost at this point doesn't matter if there are guilty parties who actually colluded or did anything or even coordinated with Russia or Russian agents related to the hacking or related to anything about the Russian meddling into the election. I mean, certainly we have seen no evidence of that. And, you know, this is a bit of a bugaboo of mine because I've looked for that evidence and the Democratic suggestions and innuendo that there is this evidence of collusion or that there has been collusion, I think is off or at least unsupported by the facts. But we're getting into this stage where it's the cover up. I mean, that's what the Comey memos are so damning, and that they reveal that Trump, in his typically ham-handed way, attempted to you know, cover this up or move on from the investigation. And it's where we get into the Watergate comparisons, where the cover up was. I mean, in the Watergate investigations, the break in and some of the original stuff was the problem, but the cover up was at least as bad. And I think like it's also telling to look at the differences in the cover-up between Watergate and this. Like, everything with, like, Nixon was, like, so calculating and strategic. And everything with Trump, including this the conversation captured in this memo, is just, like, impulsive and clumsy, you know? And likewise,
this is why I think having Mueller lead an investigation will actually be good for the Trump team, because there's no way for Trump and his aides to try to control this, to try to put an end to it, and the extent to which they can inflict damage on themselves is limited now that there's an outside probe underway.
Also suggests that Trump is especially bad in Washington at picking his enemies. He has no concept of who to pick on and who not, who to fight with. I mean, you don't take on somebody like Comey, who's that well connected and that savvy and has a Boy Scout reputation, number one. And he ended up getting something far worse than he ever could have envisioned in Mueller. So, you know, it's
and Mueller is a, we should point out, is a Comey ally. They work together. In fact, they both have, you know, this reputation for integrity, though obviously, you know, Democrats and Republicans at various times have used Comey as a punching bag over his, you know, heading of the Russia investigation, as well as his heading of the investigation into Clinton's handling of classified information during the campaign, and his famous announcement just days before the election that he was still looking into or was reopening that investigation. Nonetheless, if you look historically, like These guys are seen as paragons of integrity who are willing to speak truth to power. There's the famous scene at John Ashcroft's bedside where Alberto Gonzalez, the then attorney general, is trying to get reauthorization.
White House counsel at that point.
White House counsel is trying to get reauthorization.
This is why we have Scott Bland.
Right,
here.
Fact check. If only he could have figured out where Bob Mueller is from in Philadelphia, because Charlie and I were both commenting on, other than the fact that this guy has a great reputation for integrity, one of the other things that he has going for him is a very strong, pronounced Philadelphia accent. He was apparently raised in the Philadelphia suburbs, but Scott nor our crack Nerdcast researchers could find out precisely where. And to be fair, he did go to boarding school in New Hampshire, but he carried that Philadelphia accent with him into adulthood, even up to John Ashcroft's bedside, where he and Comey tried to overrule or tried to flag Alberto Gonzalez's request.
Through the hospital doors.
Way to bring it home there.
Around the gurneys.
But here's the thing, though. I really have to question his while the Philly accent is an admirable trait, I have to question his lowbrow Philadelphia credentials. I mean, St. Paul's boarding school, followed by Princeton, followed by UVA Law School. I mean, come on. That guy has never thrown a snowball at the vet. He's never been in a drunken fight at the Spectrum parking lot.
Let alone a snowball that had a 9-volt battery inside of it.
I feel like I need to spray you guys with a hose right now. So I do think Eliana's point about the appointment of Mueller kind of letting the steam off this a little bit is a good one, though. There's been this drumbeat, I mean, really kind of overtaking, and we're going to talk about Congress in a little bit, but like overtaking everything else this week for some sort of independent body to start looking into this. And I feel like, I think Eliana's right that this is letting off the steam, but we haven't even gotten to what we thought was going to be the big news this week on Monday, which is the news coming out of this bizarre, apparently bizarre meeting between Trump and top Russian diplomats in the Oval Office, which is yet another headache piled on top of an already bad week for the White House. Right, Eliana?
I'd say. My view on that is essentially not that Trump went in intending to disclose highly classified information to Russian officials, but that he's somebody who isn't particularly interested in learning on the job, and he wasn't really clear what he could say and what he couldn't say, and was simply sloppy in telling the Russian officials details of a potential ISIS terrorist plot. And he's not really it's not clear that he's really going to change. The accounts differ on this, of course. It was notable to me that the administration sent out National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster to defend the president because in the wake of Comey's firing, the president had undermined and discredited his vice president and his White House press secretary, Sean Spicer and Mike Pence. And so they had to send out somebody whose credibility remained intact to defend the president on this front. So I think it remains a little bit unclear what precisely the president disclosed, how highly classified it was. But I think it is clear that he's not particularly careful in what he says. And beyond that, he's not particularly interested in learning what exactly he's free what information exactly he's free to share and what he isn't. And that's unlikely to change.
And, you know, what that pushback from McMaster illustrated, again, was the deficiency in their messaging operation. Eliana's right. McMaster does definitely, he's one of the few folks high up in that administration that hasn't had their credibility tainted. And so they put him out there and he basically rejected the story, at least the premise of the story. And then he, too, was undermined the very next day when Trump came out and tweeted and said that – acknowledged that he shared intelligence with Russia and said that it was about terrorism and airline flight safety, humanitarian reasons, plus I want Russia to greatly step up their fight against ISIS and terrorism. So, you know, Trump continues to make it hard for his own staff to defend him effectively.
Charlie, you made a really good point as we were preparing for this episode that all this news this week started to raise much more prominently than we'd seen before talk of the I word among Democrats, impeachment, which actually puts – a lot of Democrats think puts them in a really bad place. Can you talk us through that a little bit and the kind of strategic thinking that the opposition party is going through right now?
Yeah, I mean, the I word or impeachment is something that Democrats have actually been talking about for a long time. I mean, folks were talking about it early on in his presidency, and I imagine there were some even before he was
sworn in.
During
the transition, maybe.
But, yeah, but here's the thing, though. That discussion was mainly limited to the fringes of the party and to the left-wing fever swamps. But now I think it's and also it did quite a lucrative business on overseas betting sites about the odds of Trump being impeached. But now I think as a result of the revelations of last week and the seriousness of them, the idea has gotten much wider purchase in the mainstream, or at least among mainstream members of the party, the Democratic Party, who will now at least acknowledge or talk about it in a way they didn't. But what we haven't seen yet is Democratic Party leaders talking about that, at least not yet. And the reason is that they understand that the liberal base is demanding a much harder line, particularly especially after the reports that Trump urged Comey to kill the Flynn investigation. But leadership has to think in more universal and broader ways than members of the Progressive Caucus or the Black Caucus. You know, they have small constituencies. They're locked down Democratic districts that they answer to. So there isn't much blowback that they're going to face. They can float these ideas. Leadership, whether it's Nancy Pelosi or Durbin or Schumer, they understand that there's no clear proof right now. There's nothing really impeachable about the smoke that's out there. No matter how serious it is, we're still not at that evidentiary level. And beyond that, they understand that impeachment chatter does little more than distract from the party's broader messaging. It sucks the oxygen out of the air. And the bottom line is it's still politically impossible. So if they did go down this path, Trump would immediately use that in his defense that it was political. And at the end of the day, after spending all this time and political capital pursuing impeachment, it can't go anywhere because impeachment is not a judicial process. It's sort of like a quasi-judicial, quasi-political process, more political than anything. And as long as the Republicans hold the House and Senate, it's not going anywhere.
That'll definitely bear watching, Charlie. Let's transition there. As we're starting to talk about Congress a little bit, to talk about them a little bit more in our second segment. And our data point for that is zero. That's the number of policy questions that House Speaker Paul Ryan got at a press conference Wednesday.
I don't worry about things that are outside of my control. I worry about things that are within our control. And that is whether or not we do what we are elected to do, which is to solve people's problems. People in America turn on the TV and they think this is all that's happening. This is all we're doing and all we're discussing. That's just not the case.
Even though the ostensible purpose of that event was to talk about policy, he and his fellow House Republican leaders opened it up by talking about tax reform. They had House Ways and Means Committee Chair Kevin Brady there to talk about it. All the questions and all the stories coming out of this event, and it seems like a lot of the time that Congress is spending right now is all about Trump and James Comey and the administration in various ways being under investigation. So, Charlie, we just talked through a bunch of the effects of the Comey memo, the Russia story, all this other stuff is having on the Trump administration. But it really does seem like it's just sucking the oxygen out of the room in Congress, too, just months after Republicans got this trifecta power, the House, Senate, and White House, to supposedly pass their agenda and start making big change.
Yeah, it's like a blanket over Washington. Nothing can get done as long as you have revelations that are this big and this serious that really threaten his presidency. You can't get policy done. It's almost hilarious to think that there was a time, remember, when there were ambitious Republicans talking about getting tax reform done before the August recess? I mean, how funny is that now when you look back? Nothing can break through this, and members are beginning to get really frustrated, and you can see it express itself in lots of different ways. And because they can't – nobody wants to know about anything else. Like when they have a press conference, every one of them is getting call after call after call from the local press. Where are you on the classified information revelation from the Russian meeting? Where are you on this? They're all – where are you on the special prosecutor issue? Where are you on this? Every question is about the Trump administration's conduct, not about the policy initiatives that have been kicking around. So, you know, against that kind of backdrop, it's tremendously frustrating for members of Congress.
I think what this also points out is yet another deficiency in the Trump operation, which is the lack of an effective outside messaging apparatus. We're talking about like an unlimited money, you know, super PAC or nonprofit group, 501c4 group that past presidents, you know, particularly since Citizens United. So Obama has, you know, used effectively with OFA to, you know, do the grassroots, what the grassroots lobbying, so to speak, to like whip up supporters to get them on board with this so that they can then exert the pressure on members of Congress to, you know, either to take a certain tact in the messaging on Russia in this case, or to push a legislative agenda. And I've talked to several Republican consultants involved in that big money world, both donor representatives and pro-Trump people, who say that the Trump outside group that was started by, you know, some close Trump allies is just not doing anything effective. It's not pushing the legislative agenda, and it's not sort of effectively countering the Russia story. It's the sort of role that MoveOn.org, which is ironically one of the original big money groups, played for Clinton. I mean, Move On, the actual name, is encouraging people to move on from the impeachment proceedings. Obviously, it didn't do a super effective job because Bill Clinton still got impeached. But nonetheless, it having it out there was important to sort of give cover. Trump doesn't have that.
I will say, you know, in retrospect, I don't think you'll find a lot of Republicans who now will say, we think impeachment was a great thing, that it was a strategy well executed, that, who will stand by that. I think actually in retrospect, a lot of people say they think it was bad for the country and derailed the Republican agenda in various ways. And I actually think that in looking at potentially a Trump impeachment, it would be possible for Republicans to use that argument against Democrats. I mean, I think that actually proved impeachment is a traumatic thing for a country to go through. And I think the Clinton impeachment made it less likely that it would happen again. It's happened very few times in American history. But, to your comments, Ken, about the outside group, I spoke to somebody this morning and raised precisely that question. And he said, they're doing voter registration, and but essentially conceded that they're not doing the type of large scale messaging that they were supposed to be doing to amplify the message that's being put out by the administration. And right now there really is no message coming.
Right. Well, that's sort of a key point there. But and your point about impeachment is well taken. But my point is that they have no one doing any messaging on their behalf, you know, coherently. And in fact, it's almost the opposite. I mean, that type of messaging would at least attempt to keep Republicans in line. Now they're not in line. And you have Jason Chaffetz talking about potentially subpoenaing the Comey memo. And on the outside part of it, you have Judicial Watch, which is, you know, an extremely effective conservative watchdog group that has just recently launched a Following the Trump Money blog. So not only is it, and it's digging into, you know, Trump's Russia connection. So not only are they, the outside groups on the right, not defending him, they're actually piling on. Now, one notable exception that we did write about just today was that the Koch brothers, who famously disparaged Donald Trump during the presidential campaign, and whose network essentially sidelined itself during the presidential campaign rather than come out in support of Trump or against Hillary Clinton, their operation did just unveil a campaign that would push tax reform and push a tax reform outline that is very similar to Trump. So that's a bit of welcome support, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not coming out and praising Trump. It's not defending him against Russia. It's not even at this point using his name. It is still, a welcome sign in this otherwise extremely hostile political environment on the right and the left.
And along those same lines, American Action Network, the Republican nonprofit that does a lot of work on House races, is spending, I think, over $13 million kind of promoting the Republican health care plan in a lot of battleground districts across the country. But I think, Charlie, to the point you were making before, one thing that is not happening, we're not seeing the White House out there getting airtime selling its health care plan right now. We're not seeing members of Congress out there kind of selling their votes on this health care plan as a good thing, because they are bogged down in answering for the administration on all on whatever enormous news is happening that day.
Yeah, I think the White House doesn't have the capacity to do it, but it's also not organized effectively enough. For example, you know, members of Congress are frustrated they don't have talking points. No one reaches out to them for how to defend against this onslaught of criticism. You know, that's complicating things. And then I think the other problem that the Trump administration has is that members of Congress are not going to put skin into the game because they don't feel a tremendous amount of personal loyalty to the president. Their loyalty is contingent on one factor alone. It is that the Republican base, 8 out of 10 Republicans, is still with Trump. It's not that they, you know, they know him well. It's not that they have deep respect for him. But what they do respect is that the base is still with him. And so they won't desert him yet. But I mean, I think it is a very tenuous connection to Trump. And as soon as you see that number drop, once it hits 70% or 60% among Republicans, then you're going to see people jumping off the ship. Because right now, you've only got three Republicans who are positioned at the furthest fringe of the Republican continuum who have really ditched him and talked about impeachment. And that is what Walter Jones, who's sort of a maverick on everything, Justin Amash.
Another maverick on everything.
Another maverick, you know, sort of the heir to the Ron Paul legacy in the House. And then what Carlos Curbelo sort of kind of talked about it a little bit. And he's from a highly competitive district in Miami. So, you know, those are not the mainstream of the party right now. But if Trump's numbers begin to erode with the Republican base, then I think you're going to see lots of folks jumping ship.
Eliana, one other thing that's jumped out to me about this, it seems not just that this story is difficult to deal with, but that the stress and pressure and intensity of it is actually like starting to drive some members of Congress a little crazy. Like they're like personally reacting badly. And I'm thinking particularly of Congressman Daryl Issa, who apparently flipped off one of our congressional reporters the other day when asked about a question about Trump. But like from a personal level, this is like this constant drumbeat of negative news is like beating people down, right?
Well, you've had the Senate Majority Leader essentially say he wants less drama from the White House.
That's like translated from Mitch McConnell's speak.
Yeah,
that's like a volcanic
giant
eruption,
middle
right?
Finger. Yeah, exactly. And say that he wants to hear former FBI Director Comey testify in public as soon as possible. Paul Ryan just now saying that he that less drama is always a good thing. So these are two, I don't know if I would call Senator McConnell congenial, but they are pretty low drama men saying essentially that they're sick and tired of the drama, chaos, tumult coming out of the White House. One thing I think is problematic is that in the past, you know, the people who have worked in the George W. Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the Obama administration, they identified themselves as Bush people, Obama people, Clinton people. They felt a sense, I think, of personal loyalty to the president they worked for because they were working towards some larger purpose or for some ideas that they really believed in. I don't know if besides the members of the Trump family, there's really a sense among the people working in this White House of tremendous personal loyalty, or among members of Congress of tremendous personal loyalty to Trump, or a sense that there's a larger idea or platform that they're working towards. And I think that leads people to – it makes it easier for people to peel off, to leak to the media, and that exacerbates all of the frustrations.
And part of that is that there is no real like Trump ideology in the sense of a traditional partisan spectrum. But you're also right about the loyalty, and that's the personal loyalty issue. And maybe they're related, that there's not a whole lot of personal loyalty from the folks who he's brought in from sort of traditional Republican institutions and offices and committees and the like. And something that we reported, my colleague Tara Palmieri and I, yesterday, is that in this moment and in this dynamic that we just discussed, he is increasingly turning to like the old hands, the folks who were with him early, particularly one name in particular, Corey Lewandowski, the original campaign manager who was pushed out amid a power struggle with Paul Manafort, has been spotted in the White House, and our sources tell us is talking to Trump regularly. In fact, he has been telling people that Trump wants to bring him back, wants to bring him into the White House to have a job in the White House as a senior advisor to, quote, bring order, end quote, to the feuding staff. And if you are turning to Corey Lewandowski to bring order to a feuding staff, you're doing it wrong.
Let's transition from here into our third segment this week. Is about an upcoming special election, and we're going to bring in campaign pros Elena Schneider, who's just in Montana, to talk about it. Hi, Elena.
Hi there.
All right, so our data point is 20, and that's how many percentage points President Donald Trump won Montana by last fall. And despite that, some Republicans are a little nervous about the House special election coming up in Montana's at-large district next Thursday, a week from today, on May 25th. So, Elena, give us the state of play in this race to replace former Congressman, now Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke in Congress. Are Republicans just nervous because they have the most to lose here in a race where they are favored, or is there actually a possibility of a red state Democratic upset?
So I got to spend a couple of days out there in Montana and talking to people and driving about a thousand miles to really get a sense of the state. And I think that what's fascinating about what's going on there is it's two things. I think it's both simultaneously. If Republicans lose here, it would be cataclysmic because this is Trump's base. This is a place, as you noted, that he won by 20 points. So if this is where a folk singer, first-time candidate Democrat manages to win, as John Tester said on the stump on Saturday, you know, this would be a shot across the bow for Republicans everywhere. I mean, this would really give people nightmares. So Republicans really do have a reason to be freaked out and nervous if this comes down to the wire. And based on public and private polling, it's been, you know, Republican Greg Gianforte, who lost a 2016 bid for governor here, has managed to hold on to about, you know, high single digits, low double digit lead. But in the last week, there's just been a lot of uncertainty and movement and things happening that could really affect what's going on here, especially the enthusiasm or lack of enthusiasm on the Republican side. So in that sense, Democrats have the momentum going into this Thursday election. And if it ends up that they have the enthusiasm on their side, funky things can happen on a Thursday before Memorial Day weekend.
Definitely seen it happen in special elections before.
Yeah, and think about the amateur hour over at the White House comes in the home stretch of that special election. It couldn't come at a worse time for Republicans.
Elena, what's driving the race at this point? How much is this national stuff playing, or is it much more about the candidates themselves that's like separated a little bit from the craziness that has been going on in D.C.?
I think that both sides would probably admit, at least privately will admit, that they're not thrilled about the candidates that they have here. Just in that, you know, you've got Greg Gianforte, who, you know, lost 6 months ago in a Trump wave year. He's somebody who it's very easy to sort of paint him as a Montana outsider. You know, he's from New Jersey. He's granted he's lived there most of his life now, but he's certainly not originally from Montana. He is a millionaire. It's very easy to sort of paint him as somebody who doesn't care about what's going on. He also blocked stream access to his ranch, and public land access is a huge issue for people there. So he's not in some ways an ideal candidate on the Republican side. And then on the Democrat side, it's a similar situation where, you know, you've got someone who is as purely Montana, arguably, as one could be, you know, folk singer, traveled across the state, fifth generation.
This is Rob Quist.
Mm-hmm. But he also has, you know, some, you know, interesting problems of his own. You know, he performed at a nudist colony, which the Republicans love to talk about. He has had some serious financial problems, which they have been hammering him on TV for being irresponsible, for financially and fiscally, you know, problematic.
Rob Quist has a long history of running up debt.
This has been going on for 16 years.
I'm sharing my story because I don't want somebody else to be taken advantage of by Rob Quist.
And so neither candidate here is sort of perfect, but they're able to, in a lot of ways, nonetheless, tell a pretty localized story.
I think that's an interesting point. People talk a lot about Montana, despite being a red state, does have a history of electing Democrats to high office. And you mentioned Steve Bullock, the governor, John Tester, the senator, who's running for re-election this year. But Charlie, I think part of it, these are really, really good Democratic candidates. Like John Tester is like as you know, like down to earth and like populist a Democrat as there is. Bullock, who was the attorney general, much the same way. Brian Schweitzer before that had kind of a that you know, cowboy shoot from the hip attitude. Like, yes, the state elects Democrats sometimes, but you also need something a little special to make it happen.
Yeah, I think Washington too easily dismisses this guy, Rob Quist. I mean, look at Congress itself. It has a long history of electing folksy entertainers. You know,
That's true.
I mean, I don't think it would really be out of the norm to elect a guy like Quist there. I mean, when you look at that race, it's interesting in what it – what it says about Donald Trump's popularity at this moment. But I'm also – the thing I'm watching really closely is what it says about the threshold for a successful candidacy in the Trump era, meaning I think that the standards that we once applied to candidates have been thrown out the window in the wake of Donald Trump's victory. And so I'm curious to know, like, what will voters what will they be able to handle and what will they be able to overlook? And as Elena mentioned, so here's a guy who played in a nudist colony. You know, obviously not in the positive column for him. But then he also got hit with the oppo hit of all oppo hits, revealing that he's got herpes, that he was smoking dope, like all these different things. Like, that is just like –
that was brutal.
You know, amazing stuff to drop on somebody in the final weeks. Like, all of these things pile up, the tax problems, all of that. And I'm curious to see, does any of that matter anymore? Will that kill a candidacy now in the Trump era after that roller coaster that we went through?
And Elena, the stuff that Charlie just mentioned came up because Quist has kind of tried to pivot the conversation of the race in the last week toward healthcare, and so Republicans are bringing up an old medical malpractice suit that he had filed. But to what extent is the Republican healthcare bill that was passed in the House, is this the first instance? This is the first instance we're seeing of Democrats trying to weaponize it in an election that's happening at the moment, as opposed to trying to set the stage for House races way off in November 2018.
Absolutely. They're trying to use this as a, you know, in a lot of ways, like the Russia stuff that's been going on, people in Montana don't really get it. They're not really sure what's going on. In this way that a lot of Americans, it's tough to follow. There's so much going on. But healthcare is a very localized issue. You can talk about whether or not your premiums are going up, whether or not your neighbor has lost their care, whether your rural hospital has closed. That matters to people there. And so they're absolutely trying to use that in the final closing days because they have a lot more evidence to point to say, look, this is what's going to happen if this law passes in the way that it is as of right now. But Republicans who I've talked to say they are deeply concerned about what it's going to mean in 2018, but are less worried about what it might mean for Montana simply because there hasn't been enough time for it to sink in yet. People haven't seen those hospital close yet. They haven't heard the consequence stories yet. So it's a little bit more difficult to tell the story.
And there's no actual law.
Right, yet. Exactly. So it hasn't passed, you know, hasn't gone through the Senate yet. So in that sense, it's certainly signaling where they're headed. It may just not be quite as effective as of yet.
Elena, is it fair to say that it's a much bigger deal if the Democratic candidate wins in the Montana special than in Georgia 6?
I think it'll mean two different things. I think if it'll be a bigger deal because it'll be Trump's base in that sense. But I would also point to, you know, as Scott was saying, Montana has elected Democrats before. So in some ways, it could just be a case of the candidates here where Greg Gianforte is somebody they rejected in the past and then they do it again. And Trump's popularity still stays the same in the state writ large. But, you know, it could also, you know, if we see his popularity decline there, then, yeah, that's his base. And that's way more concerning than a place like Georgia, which is a population that tends to be trending away from him to begin with, which barely backed him in 2016 and probably are not all that pleased with him right now.
I think that gets to a point we've talked about before with these special elections, right? Once the results come in, you can say, oh, it could have been about this or it could have been about this. But they raise all these questions and aren't always so great at answering them. But I think one thing we talked about at the beginning and we can circle back on now is if either of the Democrats is going to win this, that has the potential to really lock up Congress even more so than the Russia stuff that we just talked about is doing, right? Because losing these seats that had been traditionally Republican, even if there are reasons to understand why Democrats might be doing better right now, Democrats and Republicans seem to agree that it would inspire a lot of concern among battleground Republican members in Congress when the time comes to take tough votes for
I think it'll paralyze them. I think it'll absolutely freak them out because look at what's happening in places that are, you know, usually back Republicans by 10, 15, 20 points. And now all of a sudden that they're losing. So I think that that's absolutely going to lock things up for them legislation-wise. And I think, too, it's going to be a huge boon for Democrats in their attempts to recruit in places that are maybe 50 through 80 on the priority list for, you know, that are usually more difficult to get, but in potential wave year they could win. It's going to be a lot easier for them to get good quality candidates in those districts and raise money for them.
Charlie, are Democrats going to have a problem if they don't manage to pull one of these off and after kind of like ginning up the base to get excited about them?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the downside risk is as bad on the Democratic side because I agree with Elena that Democratic wins in these races is – and it's going to be panic in Washington, absolute panic among Republicans, that is. For the Democrats, you know, I don't think the stakes are quite as high. But yeah, I mean, there is going to be a real drop in enthusiasm. I think what you're seeing right now is, you know, just the party is nearly radicalized. I mean, the levels of energy at the grassroots base are, you know, through the charts. And, you know, you hear this from all the local party leaders, you know, more people at local meetings and things like that. And I don't think that changes that dramatically only because Trump is so polarizing and is just sticking, you know, continues to poke the bear, you know, constantly. It's not, you know, he hasn't really, one of the reasons his poll ratings aren't great is because Democrats hate him so much. And unlike other presidents, unlike, say, George W. Bush after a polarizing election, Trump continues to poke the party. He continues to be highly critical and disrespectful of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. He calls, you know, a party icon, you know, Elizabeth Warren, a derogative name. He mocks top Democrats. So he is constantly inflaming the Democratic Party. So even if they do lose these seats, I tend to think like, most people really don't follow special elections that closely anyway. I don't think it would have really a material effect on the enthusiasm level and the energy of the Democratic base.
And I think, too, I saw this on the ground when I was in Kalispell, which is way, you know, northwestern Montana. It's certainly a Republican area, Republican county, Flathead County. And people at this dinner, Democratic dinner, and then this rally for Quist and Tester, they were when I would ask them, you know, what brought you out here today? Why are you here today? It was more often than not Quist or Tester. It was, I can't believe what's happening in Washington. I need to get involved. So as you say, I don't think that the boogeyman in this story goes away even if they lose these special elections. These people are still going to be motivated because of what they see happening from the White House, not necessarily because they are totally in love with the candidates that they're trying to elect.
Right. And we should say that if Democrats do lose these two seats, it will be important to note that a lot of the hysteria that we hear in Washington among some people and a lot of the Democratic claims need to be dialed back a little about maybe a huge wave or something. And it just goes to show that, yes, there's something in the air, but maybe we don't know how strong it is yet, because if they lose those two, they will have lost those two. They will have lost Kansas 4, all of which were Republican districts, but all of which offered an opportunity that if there was this overwhelming wave of rage gripping all Americans, Democrats would have picked up one of those seats.
All right. Mark it on your calendars. Thursday, May 25th, Elena and I will be staying up very late to track the election results that night. And we are very much looking forward to seeing what happens. Elena, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And Charlie, thank you as always for joining the Nerdcast.
Thank you as always, Scott.
And as always, a big thank you to our listeners. Remember, if you enjoy the Nerdcast, please rate us, subscribe, and write a written review on iTunes or your preferred podcast app. The more feedback we get, the higher we rise in the charts, and the more people can discover the Nerdcast. And here's that survey URL that we talked about at the top of the show again, politico.com/podcast survey. It takes just 2 minutes, and it's going to help Politico create even better podcasts. Once again, thank you to our listeners. Thank you to our panel. Thank you to executive producer Bridget Mulcahy, Nerdcast illustrator Bill Cookman, and our researcher and Politico web producer Zach Montalaro. We will talk to you again next week.